Live programming for WAUK Radio 540 AM and 101 FM is produced right in the Shaw in beautiful downtown Waukesha, Wisconsin.
The Earl Ingram Show is an independent product and has a joint sales agreement with WAUK Radio. Enjoy.
All right, welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. That's 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. Sandy Williams is in the studio. Let's go directly to the phone lines. Bill, thank you for being patient and calling back.
Sandy, you guys do a wonderful job. You're a sea of reality in a world of fantasy. But what I would like to say is it's amazing how the minority is now controlling the majority. I truly believe that the Supreme Court is coming out with all these actions for one reason, through their think tanks and their organization. They're aware of that Liz Cheney and Adam Kissinger have opened a can of worms. They can't put the lid on. So they're doing this as a move for the midterms and all that to try and pull more voters to the Trump ideals. And when CJ calls in, and he knows where the bad schools are because somebody told him, not that he experienced it. It's amazing. People know what, men know what's good for women, but they don't ask women. White people know what's good for black people, but they don't ask black people. White people know what's good for Mexicans, but they don't ask Mexicans. The ability to suppress what this country's built on is amazing. And I'll just leave this with a closing thought. I believe we have to have a motive to go out and say ban all assault weapons if you want children to be first and you care about pro-life. So thank you, guys.
Bill, you
chew on what I sent you.
You said a mouthful. Thank you very much for the call. Sandy?
Well, you know, I think this whole notion of banning weapons that are already out there is the name of the game, and I know that's why LaPierre and the people in the gun movement always bring up the boogeyman of the government's going to come and collect our guns. You know why they say that? Because they know it's the right thing to do. They know that that's the only answer to the gun problem in America. We have 400 million guns out there, 20 million assault rifles. We need to start gathering those things up. We need to limit the numbers. You know, the various communities that have had those gun collection programs, you notice they don't happen much anymore because I think there probably was a backlash they experienced. But, you know, that's what we need to do. We need if only voluntary people to turn in guns so that they can be taken out of circulation. But right now, we have so many guns in circulation that our children won't be safe, regardless of legislation that's passed about the sale of new guns.
Hey, thank you very much for the call, Bill. You know, and Sandy, I want to go now to Ukraine. And Russian President Vladimir Putin ordered a pause in the invasion of Ukraine on Monday after Moscow claimed a major victory in seizing the, what is that, Luhansk,
yeah.
Region in Ukraine's east. Putin, during a meeting with Russia's defense minister, Sergei Shoigu, said all units involved in the offensive in Luhansk should rest to build up strength. State-run media outlets reported the units that took part in the active hostilities and achieved success, victories in the Luhansk direction, of course, should rest, increase their combat capabilities, and what they're getting ready to do is push forward. So, Sandy, you predicted this early on. I remember the first couple weeks of the war, and everybody was crying crocodile tears. The television cameras were everywhere. News reporters from all outlets all over the world were there and in the early stages. And you said, well, it's going to wait till it gets to be warmer. You know, this was during the winter, and so they couldn't move. Russia couldn't move on the ground when it was soaked. The fields were soaked. The ground was wet. When once all of that settled, it turned into a slugfest.
Well, and it changed geography, too. They were in western Ukraine near Kyiv, which is a much different geography, and it was urban warfare. The warfare had moved to the east. There's a couple of things about eastern Ukraine that are different. One, eastern Ukraine is filled with Russian speakers and a substantial number of Russian sympathizers, so that they didn't have the same kind of resistance amongst the general populace that they had in western Ukraine. I'm talking about the Russians now. And also, it was a much more wide open space, a space that can be the field for tank warfare, but also artillery warfare. And everyone knows that if amongst any military in the world, Russia has more artillery. They have more artillery than the United States has. So, you know, they have a focus in their military on artillery, which is a distant type of warfare, a warfare you fight, you know, like 20 miles, 15 right. miles apart. And you slug it out, and you are firing somewhat inaccurate kinds of shells that do a fair amount of damage. And it's basically the damage is done by the number of shots you make, number of shots you take. And it's a war of depletion. And Russia was going to win a war of depletion. They have more men. You know, in the eastern Ukraine some weeks ago, Zelensky said they were outnumbered 7-1 by right. Russians. And so now eastern Ukraine has basically fallen to the Russians. Now, the Russian intent before the war was to obtain something like an autonomous Donbass region, the Luhansk and Donetsk areas, and to secure a land bridge to Crimea and to have Crimea recognized as Russian territory. I still think all those things are going to be accomplished. I think they could have been accomplished through a negotiation prior to the invasion. I think Ukraine refused to negotiate, particularly its own neutrality, and refused to negotiate the notion that it wouldn't join NATO. Within a month of the invasion, Zelensky was announcing that he no longer felt that Ukraine needed to or would ever join NATO, so that was something that was yielded. So, yeah, it's terrible because Ukraine is... suffered what they announced to be like $500 billion worth of infrastructure damage during this war. It's a war that's been enabled by our munitions. It's a war of resistance in which they've done remarkably well against a larger and formidable military foe, but it's also a war that is not going to be won by them and is going ultimately to be settled by some kind of negotiation. And I still predict that the outcome of that negotiation is going to be much as I just described. That's what's happening on the ground right now. Right now, Russia on the ground has the Donbass region, the Mariupol land bridge to Crimea, and they hold those. And, you know, my hope is, quite frankly, that during this letdown, when Russia says that they're gaining their strength to not mount another initiative, there will be a negotiated settlement.
You know, Sandy, it doesn't make you feel good that you predicted that.
Well,
going back when you know everybody was
Henry Kissinger has a concept called realpolitik, and he was talking about this very same Ukraine issue at age 97, but he still seems to be sharp as a tack. And he was basically saying that the realpolitik is the notion that international affairs are the result of pragmatic evaluations of real interest. How really interested in what sort of critical and strategic value do we have, do we place on Ukraine? If we place a very high strategic value and we have a critical interest in Ukraine, then as a matter of realpolitik, we'd be willing to invest our troops, our resources, our treasure in defending Ukraine. But the fact is, on a realpolitik basis, we don't have that kind of interest in them. We have a lip service ideological interest in what we talked about, which was democracy, ignoring the fact that Ukraine was a mightily corrupt country, you know, that as recently as 2015 and 2018, this guy Manat, who was the campaign chairman for Trump, was earning millions of dollars from Ukraine. You know, Burisma was paying Hunter Biden millions of dollars to be on the board. It was all the result of a very corrupt effort by Ukraine to curry the favor of American politicians. Apparently they did. But so what's happened out of this? You know, we gave Ukraine the capacity to say no to Russia in a negotiation, which resulted in a Russian invasion, which is going to result in huge damage to the infrastructure of Ukraine, huge losses in human life in Ukraine. And the ultimate outcome, I believe, is going to be no different, really, to speak of than what would have occurred in a negotiation prior to the invasion.
You know, our investment of over $70 billion in counting, and people are still saying, not enough, we haven't invested enough. When will we come to a realization, Sandy, that even if we invested $170 billion,
I think
the outcome is still going to be the same.
I think the danger is that there's a bit of folly in the path we've taken, and that Putin had predicted that ultimately the European countries would break, the unity would break with respect to their willingness to undertake the costs that are being placed on them in this situation. And we can, after the break, we can talk about it, but I believe that there is a real risk of that happening.
All right, we've got to go to a break. 844-967-2789 is the number. My guest is Sandy Williams. You can join us. We'll be back. Welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. Sandy Williams is here, and as always, you can join us. You know, Sandy, this battle, you know, and while you were away, I kept hearing more and more conversations about the longevity of this war. And that this war looked like it was going to be a long one. And so when you hear those signs and hearing people say it's going to be a long war, a long war, a long war, what has it been? What, 5 months? Hasn't been very long as wars go right now, but
well, you know, but the world has experienced a fair amount of impact from it. So, you know, we have this big inflation in the price of fuel, and Europe is already in a recession, and their inflation is 8.6%. Our inflation rate's
8.1, something like that.
Yeah, we're at 8, and the question is whether it's that inflation rate's going to go up or down. And so, you know, I was saying before the break, I think there is a risk, actually, that the unity of the European position with respect to Ukraine could reach some fault lines. One of the fault lines is this thing that I predicted or talked about early on, which was the Sulwiki Corridor. And that's this land corridor that runs from Russia. Russia is separated from its own territory, which is called Kaliningrad, which is a port city on the Baltic that it got awarded by the West, actually, at the end of World War II, which has a big naval base and 500,000 Russians. But it's separated from Russia by Belarus, which is a close ally of Russia. But then it's also separated by Poland and Lithuania. And this Sulwiki Corridor runs along the border between Poland and Lithuania. Both of those countries are NATO countries. And Lithuania, the woman who is the prime minister of Lithuania, has announced her intention to essentially embargo, to put a blockade up to keep Russia from moving its overland, the things which have been sanctioned by the West with respect to the products from Russia and involving Russia. Russia takes the position that that would be a blockade. A blockade is an act of war. And they're right. It probably would be a blockade. And so if it's blockaded, they could take military action to support the movement of their materials on the Silwiki Corridor, which would be military action against Lithuania and or Poland, both of whom are NATO countries. Under the NATO doctrine, that would call for a response, a unified response from NATO against Russia. Would NATO be willing to do that in that circumstance? And my prediction is no. I think many countries in NATO would say that's not a transgression. That's a decision that was made by Lithuania, and it was essentially an affirmative act of war by Lithuania against Russia. So now we have the very thing that Putin predicted, which is a breakdown of the unity of NATO. And furthermore, the suffering, the economic suffering in Europe is at some point going to potentially break the back of some of those countries.
So, Sandy, if NATO, all these 32 nations have agreed, each one of them can unilaterally make these kinds of decisions that you are talking about Lithuania can do, and somehow we're supposed to support them in those decisions?
Well, there you go. That's how the thing breaks down, because Lithuania would say that they were doing it in furtherance of the sanctions which have been agreed to by the Europeans, but the Europeans themselves weren't participating in deciding that that's what Lithuania ought to do. So now we have the same, this kind of circumstance that could throw a monkey wrench into NATO unity. And furthermore, I think the level of economic impact that the sanctioning on with respect to gas and oil has had in Europe, at some point, the economic consequences of the recession are going to begin to have a political backlash within Europe. And so, you know, a long war with Ukraine is not something that is very likely to be suffered well by Europe, and is not likely to be suffered well by the unity of NATO.
You know, Sandy, and in the midst of all of those things is our nation that really is the backbone of NATO. And, you know, whether or not it's Lithuania or any of those other smaller nations that step out on their own, there's always going to be the call from the mightiest of all nations to come with us, you know. And
well, I mean, that's the difficulty of NATO, which is that the rule of NATO, that it's one stands for all and all stand for one,
right,
creates the potential for something like, and one of the reasons why there was some reluctance on the part of nations to enlarge NATO, to create circumstances like the circumstances of Lithuania, Estonia, and Latvia, which are all contiguous with Russia, were part of the USSR, clearly are the subject of a great deal of concern by Russia with respect to what happens within those territories. So, you know, that's kind of coming true. You know, we decided, NATO did in 2008, I think it was, to allow those countries to come in spite of the notion that we had basically told Russia that we weren't going to be doing such things. And so now maybe we're beginning to feel the backlash effect of that.
You know, Sandy, we're careful, and we say these other countries have come in, were allowed to come in, and we, those of us who are aware, know what's at the root of it. We know why those countries, smaller countries, have been allowed to come in, because of what we are looking to do and what we are building in that area. And well, the American people just, you know, we're oblivious to.
I mean, yeah. I mean, if we think it's strategic, then ipso facto, Russia will think it's strategic too, because the only reason we think it's strategic is vis-a-vis Russia.
Right.
because there's nothing else strategic about Lithuania, Estonia, and Latvia. I mean, the sanctity of those countries is an important thing, but strategic to the United States? No, it really has to do with their proximity.
So from your perspective...
But here, let me just finish one thing. Yeah. NATO, because it has this one-for-all, all-for-one provision, is designed to be something that would be very carefully expanded so that everyone who would be allowed into NATO would represent a country for whom everyone has that same strategic interest, okay? And the Baltic countries are something that probably... People need to think about whether and why they've decided that those are so strategically important as to have the all-for-one, one-for-all promise.
All right. Got to go to a break. 844-967-2789. We'll be back. To the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. It's 844-967-2789. You text us at that same number. Sandy Williams is still here. You know, Sandy, I want to talk now about the recession. Man, I go back to all of those years, last couple of years, with you talking about toolboxes to handle recessions and toolboxes now to handle inflation. And it's clear what is the feds are doing. You predicted that. That's what they're doing. It's starting to have some impact, some effect, but they clearly don't want to slow the economy down to the degree that it causes major pain. But it's almost too late for that now, right?
Well, you know, this every recession is different. You know, everyone fights the last war, and then the next one comes up, and it's a new and different problem. And the difference with this recession is that it seems to be a high employment recession. Okay, low unemployment recession. We don't have those. You know, the definition of a recession almost always was high unemployment.
Yes.
Stagflation was a period of high inflation and high unemployment. That's what we had in the 70s. Right now, we seem to have a labor shortage, okay, that is causing a very low unemployment, but we have high inflation, and we're beginning to see signs of recession, right? So we might end up having simultaneously a recession with low unemployment and high inflation.
So help me understand.
And this is because we have this unusual situation of shortage. One of the reasons for our recession is we can't find people to make stuff that would in turn get sold. You can't buy a new car because they can't make new cars.
Yeah.
One of the reasons they can't make new cars has to do with labor shortages that exist in various sectors of the economy, like unloading things at the dock in San Diego. That's a logistical problem that contributes to the chip problem. I mean, this is just a very unusual economic circumstance in which we have kind of the perfect storm of all kinds of logistical problems, all kinds of frictional employment issues. We have had some kind of societal change in the type of jobs people are willing to do. We have more people staying at home and not working. So this recession is going to be different than any recession we've had in the past. And I do predict, as a result, that it's going to be harder to fix, because you can't fix a recession with more deficit expenditures if the recession is accompanied by inflation, because the more deficit expenditures will increase inflation. You can't fix a recession that's caused by shortages by pouring more money in the hopper, because that will bid up the price of everything that's short, which will cause more inflation. So it's a difficult circumstance to look at. Ultimately, the pill for inflation is the inability to buy things, to bid it up. So you do have to take money out of the pocket of buyers. So ultimately, the cure for almost every recession is a bitter pill for Tom, Dick, and Mary.
So how do you then, Sandy, if people won't be getting laid off and they'll still be working through the recession, that means money is still going to be moving through the economy. Certainly probably not at the speed that it was, but it's still going to be moving. How then do you stop the economy from moving forward?
Well, right now the money that's moving through the economy is bidding the price of things up. Okay, so instead of creating more production, it's just increasing the price of everything that's produced. That money doesn't go in the pocket of the people who do the manufacturing. It goes in the pocket of the people who own the manufacturing. Okay, so the money flows upstream. But even the stock market is looking at those kind of shortages and saying, well, we're not sure about the long-term value those kind of earnings will provide, because inflation ultimately will increase interest rates. Higher interest rates will reduce the value of money earned in the future. Money earned in the future is the basis for the value of stocks, so the value of stocks goes down. So even accumulated asset value will go down in a circumstance like what we're talking about. And there will be pain. You know, the inflation will be suffered by those who are involved in the manufacturing process, which will be, and there will be a recession in terms of the number of output of products. It's an inflationary spiral that is created by shortage is very difficult to contain. It's the reason why price controls are what is used in warfare during wars to control the economy. It's why we had those books of stamps, not we, but our parents had those books of stamps during World War II to buy things not with money, but with stamps.
But so the impact of it being a global recession, does it make it more difficult for us then, because
yes,
it's out of our control?
Yes, I mean, the recessions we've had in the past have frequently been aided by, for instance, demand from China. So the growth of China during the first decade of the 2000s had helped us out of the 2008 recession, because it was a source of demand out there and a source of business activity. And we helped Europe climb out of its recession when they had all these defaulting economies and issues associated with government-issued debt, Greece, Spain, various countries. So there is a lot of international relationships. When they're all in a recessionary cycle, and if we, in fact, cordon China off from us, like there was talk of doing, you know, separating China and Russia, sequestering them again like we had during the Cold War, we don't get them to help us out of the recession either. So, but what the concerning thing now is that China's kind of going into a recession itself. In fact, they are in a recession. So when the world at large goes into a recession, there's less buoyancy in the world economy to bring us out of recession.
You know, Sandy, and I know, well, in the circles that I travel, and it's probably understandable, people aren't even considering or concerned about recession. They may not know it's even coming, and they're already on the margin. And man, it's just, you wish you could somehow wake them and say, hey, You got to really know right now is just a bad time for a lot of different things. I know when it comes to buying a car, this is not the time. I mean, I get it. I understand.
Yeah.
But you know, I got a wife that says, hey, I want my car. And
this thing about shortage and inflation. So inflation will get cured, and it ultimately
there's no question it's going to get cured.
It ultimately gets cured, but it gets cured in some painful ways because you have to take money out of, you have to make it impossible for people to bid up the price of stuff that's in short supply, and much of the reason for our inflation today is short supply of cars, short supply of oil, short supply of heating. And, you know, if you want to have something fixed in your house, get a heating and ventilating air conditioning person to come repair something, you try and get someone to come tomorrow and fix it.
Well, this is the wrong time of year to try to get someone.
Well, it's the wrong time because they're all short of staff, and they can't.
Oh, even in that.
Oh, yeah. Every one of the trades is short. Construction trade, short. Everyone who's trying to run a big construction project is having trouble with delays.
Is that because there's so many more businesses or, you know, opening up?
Well, the labor market changed. So the people who are willing to do it go to a restaurant. They're hiring staff. They're looking for staff. Everyone who studies the economy is sort of scratching their head, trying to figure out what has happened to the labor market that has created shortages everywhere in the labor market. And the fact is, it kind of exists. People have changed what they're willing to do. People who quit jobs aren't willing to come back to them. Pilots. The airlines are having this trouble finding pilots. They talked pilots into quitting 2 years ago, 3 years ago.
Right.
Now they're not coming back.
Because they didn't want to pay the wage to them. They thought these older guys are making all the money. We're going to bring newer guys in. We'll make more money. And in the long run, all of that thinking has been.
Well, all of that thinking has created this kind of frictional problem where if you want workers to do what you want them to do, you'll have trouble finding those workers in today's world right now.
All right, we've got to go to a break. 844-967-2789. We'll be back. Welcome back to the last few minutes of the Earl Ingram Show. For today, as always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. 844-967-2789. You can text us at the same number. You know, Sandy, all of this is really perplexing, man, because I remember the recessions when I was working, and I knew the impact that they had on as you're young and you're starting to build things and you're starting to acquire things, and then the bottom falls out, and especially, you know, all those years in the auto industry, we would know it was coming, and then the pain of it, and then after it was over, it'd be the horn of plenty for a while because they would ramp up again.
Yeah.
And actually what they were doing was shutting down, slowing things down. And then there came a point in time when the jobs were no longer there. Well, but
it was that inventory cycle.
Yes.
The people who were the customers during a recession got started, they'd operate out of inventory and order nothing, and the you guys had to get laid off.
Right.
And then when they started ordering again, they had to build up inventory. So they were ordering twice as many things as they were selling. So they'd build up inventory. So now you're booming for a while.
So that's not what we're talking about now.
No, we're not talking about that. And it's interesting. I know a guy in the steel business, and they can't find they have short supply of scrap steel that they make steel out of. So that's in short supply. That probably has to do with logistics,
right,
how it's collected and how it's delivered. Everybody you talk to can tell you about some snafu that exists in their supply chain or in their labor market or both. And so all of these things are contributing to reduced output. Reduced output is one of the measures of recession, right? So here we have a recession. It's not caused by reduced demand so much as it is by inability to meet demand and to have the price bid up because of shortage so that you end up with substantial rate of inflation.
Can you ever remember a time that all of those different dynamics collectively?
No.
And that's what the fear is.
I don't think economists can. And like I said, I think there will be doctorate theses written about this over the next 5 or 6 years. People trying to figure out what has happened, particularly to the labor market, and why is it that workers are in short supply everywhere? You know, if someone quits a job here, they're available to take a job there, right? So you figure it's a flux. People moving from this industry to that industry. Well, that's definitely going on, but it doesn't quite explain the situation.
So, how does that bode for a future of business creators? I mean, they may have not thought about that as they, you know, launch their new business endeavor, but now they've got to take all that stuff into consideration.
Well, I think business creation ends up finding its workers. I don't know whether it's business creation that's going to be harmed, but I just worry that it's going to be hard to get out of this recession, that the government will not be able to get us out of the recession. It's going to have to be a self-curing recession in which all these parts and this system, this watch that we have with all these complicated gears, is going to have to get rebuilt.
But Sandy,
and we broke it. You know, we broke it in the COVID, broke it, the tariff. I predicted at the time that I thought the tariffs were going to break the supply chain.
Yeah, you did.
It was a very fragile chain that would be hard to fix. And it showed some weakness in that supply chain, and then COVID found the rest of them. And it's going to be very hard to fix.
And see, with that, meaning that there's no control over when it gets fixed or how it gets fixed.
Right.
That's the fear.
Yeah, I mean, the fear is, I mean, the 2007 recession was fixed with the money flowing from the government to feed money back into an economy in which we were in a situation in which we had no inflation, and the economy needed money. The well needed to be primed, but priming the pump isn't going to help in a recession that's marked by inflation and shortage.
So when do you think, Sandy, that we'll be in a full-fledged recession by the fall? I mean, or by the winter months. I mean, it's coming. There's no question it's coming.
Well, I think it is. And I think we're at the brink of it now. I mean, I think we're at the leading edge. And we're beginning to see signs of it. And various financial markets are acting like they're predicting it. So, you know, nobody can predict these things accurately. If they could, they'd be very, very wealthy.
Well, you know, you look at the Dow, it's at 30,000. At the height, what was it, 37,000, somewhere around there?
Yeah.
And they're in panic that it's dropped 7,000 points. And I'm like, hey, people remember how far it came up?
Yeah.
I mean, to be in full panic about, well, the Dow's down, it's still at 30,000.
Depends on what price you bought at.
Oh, yeah.
If you bought it 50,
right,
you're happy. If you bought it 32,000, you're not.
Right.
So, but I mean, that's the stock market, like I've always said, is not a very good thermometer with respect to how the actual economy is doing, and frequently the stock market is off step, at the in a recession, it, the stock market can do well for a while, or it can do very badly at the beginning of a recession, and then it can start doing well before the before you get out of the recession. So it doesn't operate in direct lockstep with the rest of the economy.
So do we come out of recession before the nation, the world does, or it doesn't work like that?
Well, we probably have more capacity to do that because we still are a more self-contained economy, even with our huge deficit to China. Although I did see an interesting time-lapse analysis from 1970 to the present of the size of the exports of various countries. And the United States was the leading exporter for all these years until 2005. And all of a sudden, China appears at the bottom of the schedule and moves its way up the schedule in the space of about 3 years to the point where China is now the biggest exporter in the world and the United States is second, Germany's third. But it happened overnight. And so economic things can happen much more quickly than we understand or predict. And our capacity to get out of a recession in some respects is much more tied into the world now than it was before.
Yeah, and the fear, as you just stated about waking up and seeing China, the number one exporter, we can handle that in two ways. We can vilify them. Right?
Yeah.
I mean, which is unfortunate and not going to change anything. Or we can, like you said, just get our piece of the puzzle.
Yeah, get ourselves right.
Right.
I sat next to a fellow on a plane flying back from Newark when I was coming back from Israel. Nice fellow. But we started talking about China. And he began to vilify China, and I began to ask him just exactly for some detail about it. And ultimately what he said was, he said, you know, I don't think you're going to like it very much when China's the biggest economy in the world. And I said, well, why? You know, and what should we do about that? Is that something we should take military action? Because we were talking about military action versus China. And the next breath of what he said was, well, I don't think you're going to like it when they're the biggest economy. It's like, oh, I see. So we should take military action against China so because they don't become the biggest economy in the world.
Right.
And I think that's America is very confused about all of that.
But they can't stop it.
No. And they can't stop it, and they should certainly not think they could stop it militarily. That would be the worst kind of international crime. So, I think that America's got a solid future, particularly economically, but we got to start thinking right. And we should stop thinking about domination, and we should start thinking about success.
You know, Sandy, you start
success and domination aren't the same thing.
Well, to me, we start thinking about right when we start having discussions like the ones you and I have. And it is why I always, man, treasure our conversations because of the subject matters. I'm a guy who listens to a lot of radio, and I don't hear the subject matter that you and I discuss. And to me, that's the telling part of all of it. We're not afraid to have the real discussions about things that may make some people angry because they think as Americans we're somehow bashing our nation. We're not.
Yeah. Well, Friday we can do this again, maybe.
Yeah, we'll do it again.
Yeah.
Thank you as always. Been a blast. 72 degrees. I love it for a change. Gotta go. I'll be back on tomorrow. You've been tuned into the Earl Ingram Show. See you later. We'll be right back.